Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Japanese. I'm your host Akiko Katayama, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I will try to demystify it in this program with my co-guests. And last week, we had Elizabeth Ando, who teaches the essence of traditional Japanese cuisine to non-Japanese people in Japan. And this week, we have another passionate, inspiring American woman in the studio. Here we have Nancy Singleton Hachisu, who is a long-term resident of Japan and cook on an organic farm near Tokyo, and the author of Japanese Farm Food, published in 2012, as well as Preserving Japanese Way, which just came out in August. Also, Nancy actively advocates preservation of artisanal Japanese food production through TV and other media in Japan. Hello, Nancy. Welcome
Hello,
to the
Akiko.
Show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, I know that you are on a book tour.
Yes, and we'll on the end, thank goodness.
Yeah, almost ending tomorrow.
2 more days, yeah.
Right, and we'll talk about the book, new book, in a moment. Mm, but the first, what brought you to Japan?
Ah, well, I was in love with sushi, but more than that, actually, I was changing my life, and I was going to go to graduate school, and so I thought, if I'm going to get a JD, I may as well put a language in there too. And what have they been shouting about at that sushi place? So I decided I was going to learn Japanese and get a master's in East Asian studies along with the JD. Mm-hmm. Went to Japan for a year thinking I would learn Japanese in a year. But then I got snagged by a cute Japanese farmer and never left.
Right. Okay. So that was after you graduated from Stanford. That was 1988.
Yeah, but Stanford was at 78, and
Then
for about 8 years, 8-9 years, I was living and working in bars and restaurants in San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
So that was why I wanted to get a real life rather than that kind of life, because it was a little bit too much fun.
Right, yeah. Very dramatic change.
Yeah.
Right. So, but how did you end up living in Japan permanently?
Well, like I said, I met the guy, mm-hmm. and I didn't have any plan or desire to marry a Japanese guy, but it just was what was going to happen.
Mm.
So, and so I stayed.
Right. Well, it sounds like it's really romantic. He was your student, or
yeah, in English conversation class in the day. I don't know what happens now because I have a preschool. And hopefully, the teachers are not dating the people in the school, but. In the day, the teachers and the students became friends and often would socialize.
Mm.
And so I had girlfriends in the class, and we all went out to yakitori and stuff after class and became friends.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so then you got married and then moved to a 90-year-old Japanese farmhouse.
That's not exactly right.
Really? So, sorry.
So we got married and we built our house. It's like an A-frame sort of modern Japanese style house, like a ski cabin-ish house that we would call. And then 10 years later, we renovated my parents-in-law's house.
Oh, okay.
And we moved in with them, but in separate areas.
Right.
So in fact, when we renovated their house, we put back in a lot of the old stuff they had taken out.
Mm.
So we put back old stuff and then also modernized other stuff.
Right.
Like kitchen.
Wow. Sounds beautiful.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it's dusty, but still beautiful.
Right. But, just marrying into a family, traditional farm family, must be a little difficult for you?
Well, I think it's a lot easier for me than for a Japanese woman. And in fact, in those days, it was 1988, nobody really wanted to marry a farmer because they imagined a very hard life, mm-hmm. a very traditional life. But I, as an American, was given a lot of leeway.
Right. So, she cannot do that, so it's okay.
Yeah. So we sort of created our own path. Mm. And my husband was a very good cook, and so I saw no reason in the beginning for me to take over my mother-in-law's kitchen because he had already been living with his parents for 7 years after college, mm. and he had already been, like, manning the kitchen.
Okay.
Because his mother was not a fabulous cook. Mm. So, and by then, she had sort of lost the whole heart of cooking because she had been cooking, you know, scores of years.
Ah, okay.
You know, you just get tired.
Right. But, you know, because your husband was cooking, so that's how you got interested in Japanese cooking?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I've been cooking since I was a child. Mm. And so I'm interested in all kinds of cooking.
Okay.
So when I first went to Japan, I was madly trying to cook Japanese food from what I saw on TV, and then I got a few books, and I invited friends over, but I soon realized, I mean, just on my own, not that anybody said anything, I thought, why am I cooking Japanese food for my Japanese friends when I've only been here for 3 or 4 months?
Mm.
You know, but I just turned it around and I started cooking Western food.
Mm.
And with 3 children, we were homeschooling and having the fields and various, the fields were just for our food, but just quite busy enough. And so I did, you know, California style, Mexican and Indian and Italian, but my husband did the Japanese. And then, but just as the years went by, I mean, I just started doing it because I had to fill the vacuum when he couldn't do it.
Mm.
But we eat all kinds of food.
Okay. So your husband was a sensei, basically, or?
We didn't actually cook together so much because we had small children.
Oh, okay.
So, but when you're living in a country and you're a cook, so you absorb it.
Right.
And so when I was writing Japanese farm food, I was like, okay, how do you make nikujaga?
Mm.
And, you know, and he'd say, oh, put a little this in, like that. And then I would recreate it. And since I've been cooking all of my life, I could recreate it on the first try, pretty much, you know. So that's how it...
Great.
So life was my sensei.
Mm. Well, this is interesting. Rather than going to a culinary school, right, it's more like the will on cooking. Right? And eventually you learned a lot, not just how to cook Japanese food, but grew to be very respectful to its tradition.
Mm, absolutely.
So, and now you seem to be a little worried about you know, future of Japanese cuisine.
Mm. Well, I mean, it's not really talked about too much, but there is a big shift towards convenience store foods, including convenience store foods, where you can get full-on meals.
Right.
It's a great boon for the older people because they can get a balanced meal that maybe it's got MSG and preservatives in it, but at least it's well-balanced. It's not like getting a hamburger at McDonald's. But I think the people are sort of losing confidence about cooking, and the good foodstuffs are harder and harder to find. And so, like, people in Tokyo, on their way home, they're not going to be able to find, for instance, there's not a lot of organics either. So you can't just on your way home find organic tofu, miso, soy sauce. And so what they shelve at the supermarket is what they shelve at a lot of supermarkets here is not very great quality stuff. But certainly if someone tries hard, they can find good ingredients. We're lucky because in our town we have an organic soy sauce, miso, tofu, natto pickling place.
Right. By the way, where you live is not far away from Tokyo, but it's quite a countryside, farms and traditional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's 50 minutes on the bullet train, but a couple hours on the on the regular train. That's semi-rural. Japan doesn't really have a lot of zoning, so we've got a car wash down the street, and I mean, 7-Eleven here and there, and dry cleaning shop, and people's businesses are often on top of their house, you know.
So,
but their fields.
Well, it sounds like, you know, you are surrounded by all those classic traditional producers of great food.
We're very lucky that our area also is an organic area. We have one of the most well-respected and longest-term organic farmers in the Kanto area. Mm. He's been, his family's been doing it for over 50 years, maybe close to 60 years.
Okay.
The Suka family. Right. And they do natural farming, which is called Shizen Noho, so you know, in Japanese, and they don't just farm organically, they don't put animal products in the field.
Mm, okay.
So it's a really special type of farming, and we're very lucky to have them in our next town.
Right.
And my husband grows things that way too.
Mm. Well, you mentioned that there's not much organic food supply because there's no Whole Foods, I guess. but still people are trying to be moving towards more organic, you think?
Japan always seems to be just a little bit off of what's happening in the trends happening in America or U.S., whatever. There's certainly young people who are moving to local areas, people concerned about. I mean, after Fukushima, there was a lot of people that moved out of that area and moved to rural areas. We live near these small little mountains, and so having mountains close by, you get people looking for an alternative lifestyle. Mm. And so I make soy sauce with a group, and the people that organize it is this young couple who are living up in this teeny little town. They've moved from an urban area to rural area. So, yeah, I mean, it's reviving. I think probably preserving. There's less and less grandmothers doing the preserving because they're getting older, and probably the 50, 60-year-old set is too busy to still do it. And there's a revival, and I think that, you know, it might even be single men who might be more interested for some reason, for looking hobbies, you know. But definitely it's on the rise. But also, Japan didn't have a lot of internet access, and so...
Mm. Yeah, that's weird. Interesting.
And that's funny, but people didn't have regularly computers in their home. They had an internet access cell phone before computers in the home, you know. But... And we had Wi-Fi was very slow to get to Japan in the house, but
They are connected, but not in the way we do. It's more like a phone based.
Exactly. But now, because of the use of internet, that even if the producer doesn't have internet access or a website, there's some way you can find these artisanal products, and that's what's really changed. So all of a sudden, Japan is like wide open for all of these cool local products. I mean, totally findable.
Right.
If you put effort in.
And also, I think, last year, in December, Japanese cuisine was named as the World Heritage.
Right.
So there's a movement by the government.
Absolutely. The government wants to make sure I say we, but I'm not a Japanese citizen. I live there. Live up to the title and keep it.
Mm.
Totally. Yeah.
Right. So, okay. So in other words, there's the crisis, but... including you, so their people pushing the tradition towards staying alive.
The great thing about Japan is it's a small country, and it's a country that historically has been able to change really quickly on various points.
Mm.
And so those artisanal, you know, production, that artisanal production is still in place. Mm. We haven't lost it. So just shouting it from the rooftops is a way to keep it. And having people actually... use these products, value these products, you know, not just pick up the cheapest one, but why is this one more expensive? Because it's not because it's fancier. Mm. It's because it's been aged for 2 years in cedar barrels. And oh, by the way, these are organic Japanese soybeans,
right,
which make up 0.003% of the production in Japan.
Mm.
You know, so very special.
Right. Well, actually, I was reading your book, The Preserving the Japanese Way, which we're going to talk about in a moment. But in the book, you say craftsmen, farmers, fishermen, and local artisanal producers of traditional Japanese foods all contribute to the crucial fabric of Japan.
Yeah.
And they represent the heart of Japan and the deep pride that Japanese have. So, do you think that traditional Japanese workers have different mindset attitudes towards
absolutely.
What they do?
Yeah, it's so deeply ingrained to do a good job, and a good job because they respect the job itself.
Mm.
And it was mind-blowing for me. One time I was thinking of a topic for a talk, and I explored the idea of this, and I thought about, oh my God, what about those people that clean the trains?
Mm.
Even the people that clean the trains, this is what you would say is a menial job maybe, but they do it with such pride and they do it so well and they're wearing these jaunty caps,
right,
you know? And so the job itself is so well valued. Mm. Now, how that will continue is a question because of the education system and because of the lack of, I think the younger people are not as inclined to become an apprentice, for instance. Mm. I was happy that my 20-year-old just decided to become an apprentice for our soba master. Mm. It's a 5-6 year commitment, means working 6 days a week from, 12, 13, 14 hour days. It's a big commitment.
It is.
But you become a master at something. Now, how amazing is that?
Right.
And that the longevity of it, the time you put in, that's something that we tried to teach our children through homeschooling and through what they did. But
right. Well, that reminds me of when I grew up, I went to Japanese elementary school, and everybody was in charge of cleaning the classroom after class. And something like, when you fly out of Japan, you see all the mechanics bow to you for safety, and that makes me cry almost every time. So I think that's...
I've forgotten that. I don't look out the window very much. You're right, though. That's true. Yeah. There's a deep respect for the job, and I that's something that's very moving.
Mm, right. Okay. And I think there's another quote from the book, and your husband said, "Japanese believe there's a soul in every object, every part of life, and they don't even think about it. It's in their DNA, so it is impossible not to do a good job. It would be disrespectful to the soul of Japan."
Yeah.
Do you agree?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. And that's why simple things, like, for instance, fish sauce, Japanese fish sauce, which is totally not available here, it's just so good because it's so well made. And because the respect started from the fishermen taking the fish from the sea.
Right.
And how they fish is, it's got that long tradition of knowing that the fish needs to stay fresh.
Mm. Right. It's almost the passing of life from the fisherman to the other person to the table, like it's responsibility.
Mm. Everything along the way is crucial.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm. So is that another reason that you collect your antique cookware to preserve that?
Also because if something, you pass by something and it's $10 and it's 50, 60, 70 years old bowl or basket or box, how can you not buy it?
Right.
$10,
Right. Is it a flea market?
So, yeah.
Right. Great.
Yes.
All right. And maybe could you give us an example of a Japanese artisanal products? I mean, the food could be, or maybe cookware.
Well, for cookware, I always say the most useful tool in my kitchen is the suribachi. It's a grooved bowl. It's a grinding bowl, but you could use it, and we use it for grinding, mostly for grinding sesame or sometimes walnuts for kurumiae, or grinding tofu. But I also use it for like French food, for brandad, or for making chilorio, for burritos, so for pounding meat or fish. Mm. So it's useful for all cuisines.
Right.
But the key is to get a big one. And you can buy them in New York at Corinne.
In Tribeca.
Yes.
Like a nice company.
Right. And they have them online. But I buy mine, I buy antique ones because they're bigger and they... don't seem to be a popular item for people to rebuy.
But once you own it, you really find it useful and stable.
Yeah. But actually, that piece is almost extinct in the Japanese kitchen.
You think so?
I know so.
So sad.
Yeah. In fact, I went to a home center and I wanted to get another one of the pestles. Mm. It's called a surikogi, as you know.
Mm.
And the 30-year-old woman who I asked did not even know what that word meant.
Oh, wow.
And I went around to various home centers. I couldn't find them, and I had to go to the traditional Japanese hardware store to get one.
Oh,
and
no.
Basically, everybody who I talked to, because I ask questions a lot, and they say, oh, yeah, I don't use that anymore. They use a grinder or mixer, those kind of things. There's more. But it's sad.
Right. Well, I like the feeling when I grate the sesame seeds, you smell
grind
it,
them.
And
yeah.
It's really, some vibration.
Yeah, absolutely. Something. It's very tactile. But there's some very simple Japanese ingredients, and like the bowls that are the food culture drastically changed after the war.
Mm.
because these heavy bowls, these heavy pots, they were just too heavy.
Right.
People were looking for a light feeling, a light feeling in their life in many ways, and just physically and also just mentally, I think.
Right.
And food-wise, too, the country was depressed, and so to feed the country or to keep them in soy sauce, big soy sauce producers or big vinegar makers, they started making very cheap, quick products to get the product out there.
Right.
It's a way, it was just a way of life, and there's nothing you can do about that. I mean, it's just how it happened.
Right.
But
well, this sounds like it's a parallel with what's happening here, because you know, everybody's looking back, and then the whole food system is destroyed. So everybody goes to the green market and
yeah.
local sustainable. So sounds like the same thing's happening in Japan too.
And in Tokyo, there was a farmers market. And recently, there is a farmer's market, and it's recently become excellent. In the beginning, it was not so good. Yeah.
Like here, too. Like in New York City, Green Market. Right. So let's talk about your books, because I think your philosophy is summarized in the books. So first, why did you write the first book, Japanese Farm Food, that was published in 2012? And according to the book review on Amazon, it's not just a book about Japanese food. It's about love, life on the farm, and the community.
Yeah. Why I wrote the book was because David Leibowitz told me I should, but no. I had never seen a book like that, the food that we ate. And most of the Japanese cookbooks that I had seen were more what I call town food, more stylized food. More. We just would never ate that food ever, ever. I'd seen it in restaurants, but it was restaurant food for me, the stuff in the books. And it was also female cooking. And I guess I'm much more attracted to male cooking. So my husband doesn't use sugar, which was how Japanese food, I mean, post-war, there's a lot more sugar happening in the food. But in town food, he uses more sugar because the vegetables don't taste good. So you got to add something, you know. But our food came from the fields, and so it was all about the vegetables and the products. And we always used good soy sauce and good vinegar. And and then there was my friend Kanchan, who was a soba restaurant, and some of the dishes were from him. And then, so basically, that's what it was all about, just the food we ate. And I just wanted to say, hey, here it is, and here is the country, like, how I know it. Like, the people I know, they're direct, they're easily approachable, they're not a big mystery. The food is not a big mystery, but this is how we eat. So if somebody says it's not authentic, they don't know, because in fact that's how we eat, and we are a Japanese family. So I mean, there's different paradigms in Japanese food. So a lot of the books are out there, it's not that they're not authentic, they're just different, you know.
Right. And it's that you know, the love and life from the farm part, that's, you know, from the products from the soil. But and the community, is that something you help each other with other farmers, or how?
Yeah, the community. So, you know, the community paradigm was that you had people on your street, the Han, and you did community activities together, whether they were matsuri festivals or deaths or weddings. But as people stopped being farmers, they stopped being available to, they couldn't just stop their company job to help out on these things. So this small community group has sort of gone by the wayside for the most part. But our community is not our immediate neighbors, but like the soy sauce people, my friend who grows things for our miso and soy sauce group, but also has a little mayonnaise factory, and my husband used to supply him with eggs, and our farming friend, and so we're all my friend who's a foreign group couple who have a natural food company, and so it's that sort of community.
Right, it's more in between, rather than just having two apartments together and then meet each other. It's more kind of deeply rooted
relationship. Yeah, and it's sort of supportive and mutually supportive.
Right. And so what is Japanese farm food? What is the difference from regular Japanese food? I mean, you said it's not stylized, but
just what I said. I mean, you go to the field, you, mm-hmm. you pick a bunch of mm-hmm. greens or broccoli or whatever, and then you're just going to make a big dish.
Nice.
Like goma, you're going to do the sesame treatment, or you're going to saute it with miso and saute it with onion oil and then add miso at the end, you know, or soy sauce, or it's just going to be very simple.
Right, but it sounds like, you know, if you go to the supermarket, you choose, but in the farm life, you are chosen by the produce in a way.
Right,
that
exactly.
That determines your
table. Whatever's ready is what you'll be eating. And even if we buy vegetables, our friends, we do buy vegetables from our local friends, and they have a little table at the local Japan agriculture shop, and there's maybe a variety of five, if you're lucky, organic vegetables, and that's what I'm going to use.
Mm.
But it's actually very freeing because there's such a small group of choice, so that you don't have to make the choice.
Right. Okay. All right. So now let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about Nancy's latest book about Japanese pickling. So please stay with us.
Hi, this is Dave Arnold from Cooking Issues, and I'm here to talk to you about the Museum of Food and Drink, which is finally getting a brick-and-mortar space right here in Brooklyn, New York. So the Museum of Food and Drink is opening the MOFAD Lab, our first laboratory and gallery space, where we will be putting on an exhibition called Making It or Faking It, the history of the flavor industry. It tackles a very important topic, which is how the food system got to be the way it is now as a result of the intervention of the flavor industry, how that happened. Get your tickets at tickets.mofad.org to come see the first exhibit ever of the Museum of Food and Drink at the MOFAD Lab, brought to you by Infinity on 62 Bayard Street.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Nancy Singleton Hachisu, who is a longtime resident of Japan, cook, and author of two books, Japanese Farm Food and the Preserving the Japanese Way, which just came out in August. So tell us about the new book, Preserving the Japanese Way, and it's how important is preserving in Japan, first of all?
Preserving is, it's a 1,000-year-old tradition. Mm-hmm. A lot of the modern methods sort of were developed in Edo period, last 300 years ago or so, 300 or 400 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Preserving, there's pickling and preserving. And pickling is typically not a pickle that, like we think of as Western pickles.
Mm.
Pickles are not vinegar-based.
Right, okay.
Yeah, they're salt-based. Mm. Salt includes miso or soy sauce and fish sauce. And so salt-based pickles, they leach out liquid, and so they're not something that's going to be holding for a long time.
Okay.
They're quick pickles.
Mm-hmm.
And they typically use some sort of artisanal product like salt or preserved product like soy sauce, miso, fish sauce. Also, sake lees are used for
Sake lees are interesting, because it adds it converts the texture, like break it down, and then adds some of umami.
And recently, koji, the spore, rice koji has become a popular little method for doing. You would make a concoction called shio koji, salt koji, or soy sauce koji, It's developed by this woman in Oita, Oita Prefecture. Easy to make.
Right. And that shiokoji became such a big boom. Everybody bought it and the stores all sold out.
Right. Now the boom is over.
Okay.
They come and go quickly.
Right.
Yeah, but it's still, I mean, still available. But koji's been around, but it was not, it was around in a sort of not very great form. It was a cake form that my husband used it for making dobudoku, like a homemade, it's not sake, it's a homemade sake drink, you know, or some sort of preserving of fish. But now we can get good rice koji because of the koji boom.
Okay.
Shiokoji boom.
Interesting.
Then there's, so that's, those are pickles. And the beauty of that is that they're really easy to make. So 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes and you can eat them. And they'll involve various aromatics or like ginger or hot pepper, or they could be using some, you could use umeboshi, the salted pickled plums. So you're using fermented products to make a quick pickle or katsuobushi,
right.
You know. And that's kind of a beautiful idea, I think, because it's done quickly and you can eat it right away.
Right.
And then there's the preservation, hozon shoku, and that's for keeping. And generally done in the winter. And some of the, you know, the quintessential too in the winter is the takwan, the half-dried daikon pickle in rice bran. And then also the haksai, napa cabbage, salted napa cabbage, very similar to the sauerkraut method, but just a different flavor profile. And those are, those were going to be the hardest pickle I put in the book, along with the umeboshi, the summer one. But then I just got sucked into the rabbit hole and found more and more and more and more interesting methods that I thought, I mean, they're not available in English, so I thought, okay, I'll put them in the book and as methods. And so all those crazy preserving people are out there, culturing people, you know, go at it and give it a try.
Yeah, does it include, I think, I read an article about this book, and then there's salt pickled chopped fish that takes 3 years to be ready to be eaten. Is that in the book?
Oh, yeah. A fish sauce.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah.
Okay. So, do you have an example and a quick version to motivate listeners to buy the book, maybe?
A quick version? Well, like I said, I think those, all the quick pickles, but what I think is very special about this book is that for me, Japanese farm food, okay, that was the food we ate. Those, that was our community. I wanted to introduce what the Japan that I knew, the direct, real, honest Japan. Okay. Then this book, I wanted to really focus on the producers because of them, the guys that make salt or there's women making salt too, but it seems to be men a lot. But the people that make salt and why is it so special and what is it they're doing? And, you know, these are all small producers that are probably not making a lot of money, I'm going to say, you know, the miso producers, the soy sauce, fish sauce. I mean, all the producers, we should be so thankful that they're keeping at it.
Right. Because they're craftsmen. They're not doing it for making money.
Right. And a lot of them, along the way, there's been, I've noticed a trend of the son goes to Tokyo for college, university, then comes back, or the daughter, and comes back after about 10 years to the father's company and takes over. And so you have to really applaud them for, you know, coming back and taking over this artisanal production.
Right.
Because without it, we wouldn't be able to have, so why are these little quick pickles, why are they so delicious? Because you have excellent vegetables, farm organic vegetables, and then this incredible soy sauce or incredible miso, then of course it's going to be fabulous together. Right?
Right.
And so with any old miso or any old soy sauce and any old supermarket vegetable, it's not going to be elevated very far.
Right. Okay.
So that was important for me, the producers.
Right. Okay. And, you know, basically there's great ingredients and everything, and you can actually support those artisanal producers by buying things at the higher premium price. But what do you think is a meaningful to preserve things by yourself? It takes time and effort. So
Oh, well, I think it's also about yourself. Like, it's the challenge. And it's actually doesn't take that much time and effort, because these are methods by people who are busy people. Like, farmers are busy people, or right. fishermen are busy people. And so it's not a big elaborate production,
right.
but it just takes time and good fish or good salt or good soybeans. Miso, for instance, is, I mean, it's really easy to make on a small basis.
Right. Well, actually, it used to be that every single new wife had to have a recipe of her own miso. Every single family. So, yeah, that's a famous thing. And then, yeah, you're right. It should be quick and easy once you know how to do it.
Well, you know, even miso, you know, I mistreated my miso so badly this summer. I was quite busy. I think I stirred it three times maximum, and it still is delicious. You're supposed to stir once, starting in May, once a month, and then every 2 weeks, and then once a week. And out of the summer, you're going to be stirring it 10 times and or more. And my poor little miso, two, three times max.
That sounds like a kid.
You can neglected, but still delicious.
Right. Okay. And
but also I wanted to say that the book is not just about pickling and preserving. It's also about how do you use miso, or how do you use, there's recipes for using the product too.
Right. And there's an extensive, detailed, precise explanation of each product. I was impressed.
How
I was
to choose.
I didn't know. Oh, I didn't know this. Right. By the way, you started to be on the media by word of mouth reputation a while ago. And currently you travel around Japan and visit local artisanal producers for a weekly TV program. So what kind of people do you feature?
Well, like I said, the people that are doing a really good job, like there's a soy sauce guy in Anshodoshima who's making his soy sauce still in the barrels. Our soy sauce producer, of course, is using the cedar barrels. But this guy, not only is he still using his, you know, his family's barrels, but he started to make with his local carpenters, he started a whole project to make these large, they're actually called buckets in Japanese, but these large barrel cedar barrels.
Right. It's much bigger than a human being, right?
Yeah. And there's only one producer in Japan who's making them in all of Japan.
Oh, wow.
And they're about to stop being able to make them because they have nobody to take over their company. And so this one soy sauce maker, it's Yamaroku soy sauce in Anshodoshima, he's reviving the making of barrels.
Oh, wow.
And so he's got two things going now. It's fairly impressive. So that kind of thing, or
By the way, so what's the difference when it comes to the taste of the soy? It's made in wooden barrels. Do you have any?
It's more round. It's more deep. It's not just the barrel, though. It's also how the koji's been cultured on the soybeans and barley. So the culturing of koji itself is a whole art. Also, and the natural enzymes and spores that are hanging around in the area that's where the soy sauce has been made. They're not yeasts, but they're like wild yeasts, you know. So it's the whole, and the beans themselves, there's just so much going on.
Oh, it sounds like old brewery or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly, right.
So activity within the wood.
But, I mean, it's like I make miso with my friends, and also from rice koji from Yamaki, our local organic soy sauce place. And they're totally different tastes because you can taste the years that have gone into the developing of this koji strain. It's pretty amazing. And they're fermenting side by side.
Interesting.
Very sweet, very dark.
Okay. And then that was a really interesting. And I watched actually the program, and then that soy is so deep and rich that you can put it on ice cream.
Like caramel. It's good like that, yeah.
Right. But how do you find those interesting producers?
Yeah, it's through word of mouth or from research, or, you know, basically like that.
Hmm. Okay. And there should be plenty, but they're still hidden, and they need some sort of promotion.
Absolutely.
Being known and they
Absolutely.
Purchase.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. It's my mission.
Hmm. And also, you have a part of the project, Japan Brand Project, by mm-hmm. the Japanese government mm-hmm. to promote those producers too. Mm-hmm. So what is that?
Well, it's not by the government, but they're supporting it. Mm-hmm. This our particular project is getting better ingredients to foreign countries. Mm. Right now, first it's the United States.
Okay.
Getting good rice, organic rice vinegar, good soy sauce. Mm. And it's the same soy sauce that Nama Shoyu that's been sold by Osawa. It's our local soy sauce. Mm-hmm. But now the company will be also exporting directly. Mm. And their misos.
Okay.
And this delicious ponzu that was made for the project at my behest. Mm. And so I'm just like the third part of this. It's the soy sauce people and the organic vinegar people. And then I just give advice and promotional and put my name on it, whatever that means.
Mm, right, but that's great because the Japanese market is it's not totally saturated for that kind of premium product, but it's better considering how Japanese food is popular here. It's better for
the
small farmers.
There's not that many great ingredients, I'm going to say here.
Right, okay.
Right. I bring my own.
Mm. Oh, speaking of, I learned that you make your own soy sauce,
mm-hmm.
and then you have different vintages.
Oh, yeah, because different years you're pressing it.
Mm.
Right.
Well, I don't think many Japanese people, I haven't seen somebody bottling by the vintage in Japan either.
Well, I mean, you press it in a certain year, mm-hmm. and so then in that case it is a vintage,
right.
you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. And right now, your husband, both of you farm?
I haven't done anything on the field since I was writing Japanese farm food. I have no time.
Okay.
And we've never sold vegetables. It's only just for the food for the family.
Mm.
But my husband, his free range egg business was destroyed by the freak snowstorms last year.
Oh.
So actually, for the first time, he is selling what he's growing. He's growing wheat and soybeans for the organic soy sauce company.
Right.
So now he is an official,
okay.
but a farmer is just, they have a farming lifestyle, agrarian lifestyle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. And what's your next plan?
Next plan, I'm writing a book for Fiden, Japan, the cookbook. And that'll be out in the spring of 2018.
Okay.
And tonight and tomorrow, dinner at Marlo.
Okay, Marlo and Sons.
Right.
Right. So you're going to cook something?
Ken's cooking, but I'll be there.
Okay.
Yeah. I brought a bunch of stuff to use. Yeah.
Right.
So all the artisanal ingredients mm-hmm. are there waiting.
Okay.
Being cooked as we speak.
Yeah, so the listeners who wanted to try your food and basically go to Marlo and the Sons in Brooklyn?
Absolutely.
Williamsburg.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Thank you for joining us today, Nancy.
Thank you, Akiko.
And
glad to come.
Yeah, so please come back.
Okay.
With your, of course, with the next book, the third book.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But before 2018, please.
Yes.
So if you'd like to know more about Nancy's books and activities, please visit nancysingletonhachisu.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. And by the way, we just launched a beautiful new website, so please visit that page. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher Podcasts. Today's show was made possible by Santori, and our engineer is Liz Smith. I'll see you next week.
Program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.